Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck Nicks? What's happening? This is WTF, my podcast. Welcome to it. How are you? You all right? I want to clear something up. A few people noticed this, and I'm bad with names. Ekperigin. Naomi Ekperigin. I know I said Ekperigin. I know, because it's not a matter of disrespect. It's not even a matter of not listening. I just get something in my head, and I can barely remember names to begin with, and I lock in. It's ridiculous. I have a woman that's going to be opening for me a bit out in the road, Lara, and I still can't do it right. Lara. Why is that so hard? Lara Bites. Lara. Lara, Lara. Laura, Lara. Wait, there's just some things I can't, I don't know if it's old or it's a brain glitch. Is it a brain glitch? It's a brain glitch. A brain glitch? Fuck me. Naomi Ekperigin. I'm sorry to her and to the people that annoyed. It annoys me more in retrospect. You know, it's hard to Ekperigin. It's slight, but a name's a name. Look, today though, listen to me. Today I'm going to talk to Orny Adams. Now, this is sort of a big deal. It's a big deal in a lot of ways in retrospect. Now, after I've done it, it's a big deal. So Orny Adams has really, I didn't have a beef with him, but man, did he annoy me and rub me the wrong way. And man, was I sort of, you know, kind of, it just really shut down around him, and a bit of a bully to him in a way. I just was really tried to keep him at arm's length. He really got under my skin. And the thing is, I've never denied the fact that he can do comedy. The guy can kill, you know, he kills this guy. But for a decade or more, maybe two decades, he just, every time I saw him, I was like, ugh, I can't take it. I can't take it. Why? I don't know, because he's a little bit, there's something about him that's fundamentally a little annoying. But I never really talked to him at length. And look, he was in that documentary Comedian, which did him no favors. But I just decided, I mean, some of you know him from that. Most of you know, a lot of the older people know him from the Comedian documentary, Jerry Seinfeld doc. You know, he was the annoying guy. But, you know, we all had different feelings about, you know, the attention he got during the shooting of that, if you were in New York watching it happen. But anyways, maybe you know him from MTV, the MTV series Teen Wolf. Now, this is his bread and butter. But, you know, he can fucking kill with the stand up. But he really fucking annoyed me. And there's other people that really fucking annoy me. And it's like, why bother even, you know, saying that or acting, it doesn't matter. He doesn't have any impact on my life. So I realized recently that it's like, dude, you know, we're getting older. Let's make this right. Let's figure it out. Let's have him over and talk it out. And I got much more than I bargained for about really the impact that doing that documentary, which does not make him look good. And I used to hand out this article about him that was written for Harper's about the Montreal Fest. I think it was called 6 Minutes of Funny. I used to have it on my hard drive because I think it was one of the greatest articles written about a comic in a horrendous way, but it was very honest. And I brought that up like it was a positive thing during this interview. And he's like, oh God, like this guy has had the, any, it's, this is not cancel culture. This is some other, this is not, you know, doing something wrong. This is something hanging over a guy because it made him look bad and it made people think he was annoying and difficult to work with. And it stuck. So this documentary he did like 20 years ago has hung over him. And when we talk about it, I don't know how he dealt with it really. Well, I do. I'm going to talk to him about it. But I mean, but it's like he couldn't get out from under it. And it's still sort of happening. I mean, and I'm sort of, yeah, I'm part of that. I mean, there are a lot of us comics are like, you know, there's something, look, you know, he can do the job, but he's like, there's something unnerving about the guy. He's very earnest, works very hard, very intense. But, you know, he's there's something about him. And the documentary kind of solidified it. And I don't think he's had an opportunity to really give his side of it or talk about it frankly. And it just sort of that happened here with me. I didn't expect that. I didn't know what to expect. And I actually ended the thing and then we had to turn it back on because there was more. It just ended up, you know, and I just had to, I was really concerned that I would bust his balls or bully him or be a dick to him, which I've been for 20 years. I had to fight it. I laughed, cried instead. I kind of laughed, cried instead. But anyways, this as a, in terms of being a comedian interview, this is a big one. It's a big one. And I just said like, fuck it. I'm going to have him on and get to the bottom of this. All right, look. So I'm back from Albuquerque and, you know, I'm flabby as fuck. I never feel great. And I don't know if you know this, but like 7 or 8 months ago, it's a long time ago, I went to some holistic practitioner, a Chinese medicine doctor who's not Chinese. But I got referred to him, you know, a guy knew a guy. I think it was Flanny at Largo said, I can't remember which celebrity friend of his went to this doctor, you know, to just get a tune-up. You know, I'm not all in Western medicine. Like, I have an open mind, but I also know that, you know, you have to have a regular doctor and then you can do this nonsense. And I'm not saying that in a condescending way, but I went to this doctor with the general. He's like, what's up? Right away, the guy's in my face. He's like, what is it? What's going on with you? He's like, he's all in. You know, he's like, he's charming. He's doing this dance. It's like, what are we going to fix? Where are we going with this? What's going on? Tell me your life. What do you got? And it's like, it's a lot of juice. It's a lot of sales juice. But we laid out. I said, well, I don't know. I just don't feel great. You know, I'm 58. And I told him, you know, we went over some of the, from my health records. I brought all my tests to him. So this was the idea that this guy's going to do every test of everything to check all the levels of all things. This is the sham of it. But also, look, man, if you believe, you believe, right? I'm not shitting on the guy, all right? I like the attention. I enjoy taking tests. I enjoy numbers of, like, what do the tests show? So finally, all these results come in. And he's got this stack of papers, and he's going through the papers, and he's got a magic marker, and it's a great shtick. It's a great shtick. He's like, look, this is going on, this is going on, this should be higher. It's like, what does that mean? It's like, it could influence this. One of the good things, your genetic markers are okay, because you know you got some of this, but you don't got that. This balances out, and then he starts going through these papers, like, look, your level's a little high. We could change that. This can use to come up with glucosamine, this trimictophan, you know, and it's sort of like, you know, you're flickadicking, it's a little, that could be better if we added a little of this, because this has a profound effect on, you know, how you move your thumb. You know, it's just like it gets very specific. A lot of papers, you know, he's going through them, he's throwing the papers on the floor, he's saying, we got to get you on this, we got to get you on that. And I'm just like, and I'm looking at him, and I think he kind of knows that I know that he's fucking, you know, I know he's hustling me, I know he's scamming me a little bit, you know, but this is it, man. This is the sales pitch. Look, I got a lot of papers, I got a magic marker, I got numbers, I got indicators, I know what these things mean. It's like, you need more of this because this affects you that. But I'm one of these people that even though I know, I'm probably going to try it anyways. It's like, I know you're fucking with me, but okay. Fuck with me. I don't think that's being a complete mark. Okay? I think there's a difference between like a guy going like, really? Wow. And all right. Yeah, all right. I'll do it. I'll try it. It's not going to hurt me to try it. There's a difference. Full mark is no kidding. So if I take it, oh, geez, this is amazing. So how did I not know that I needed to take, you know, 40 pills a day, you know, because of all this stuff? That tone, and this one is like, nah, fuck, that's a lot of bullshit. And all right, but let's do it. I'm here. I'm halfway in. Let's go the whole run. So now I'm out like $2,000 over the, you know, however many visits I've had, and a bag full of supplements. And I'm sitting there like an idiot taking them, some in the morning, some at night, thinking what? Thinking what am I waiting for? And what, whether he thinks I knew was onto his bullshit or not, I'm sure, you know, given that those supplements probably cost him a nickel, and that, you know, whatever it took to print that, I paid for the test, I paid for the visits, I paid for the vitamins. And I think he gets some back end on the fucking testing. So like that guy still walked away with a couple grand. And me, I had to fucking hover over a French fry tray and shit in it and then put that into a fucking cup of liquid of some kind. I had to pee. I had to take blood. I had to, you know. Yeah. A French fry tray. That was how specific this was. I don't even know what we learned from that. And I'm sorry if it grossed you guys out. All I know is that I'm taking a lot of supplements, and I can honestly say I'm not sure I feel better. And that guy just made a couple grand. Who cares if I come back? Look, Orny Adams, he's at the Hollywood Improv this weekend, July 15th and 16th. His podcast is called What's Wrong with Orny Adams. Get that wherever you get your podcast. And this is me having a, not tense, but at times awkward and revealing conversation with Orny Adams. Where do you live? Do you do a podcast?
I do.
You do?
I do. I live, we all do now, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You get it. It's
I get it. I started it.
No, I agree. I agree. And I actually commend you because I think it's remarkable what you've accomplished now that I've tried it.
Yeah.
The one thing I've learned from doing my own podcast is I now have respect for the radio people that I shit on the road for so many years.
It's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird talent. It's a specific talent. I mean, I think I always had a certain amount of respect for the guys that did that well. You know, there are guys that were annoying. There's a lot of ego to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, God knows with people like you and I, you know, there's instantaneous ego battles with anybody assuming a position that we're like that. And there's something particularly annoying about radio guys.
Right.
But when you were on one that worked, it was elevating. I mean, like I did morning radio for a year or two, right? So to be on a morning crew where you got to keep that juice going.
Right.
The thing that changed my mind about it was I knew when we had a guest on that the last thing you wanted was them to fuck up the momentum. Right. So if you've got a vibe going and a comic walks in, he's like, no. It's like, oh, fuck.
Right.
He just fucked up the whole group. So I had respect for the job, but some of them got a little shitty about podcasts. So I still have a resentment towards the ones that are sort of like these podcasts.
Right. Yeah. Right. I agree. So I do mine out of in my backyard. I've got a Shasta trailer.
Uh-huh.
Like a vintage, and I converted it into a podcast studio.
What is that, like an Airstream?
It's sort of, yeah. Shasta, you can look at Shasta. It's a very, like, mid-century modern.
Okay.
Very cool. And
a trailer that you'd have to hook up to a hitch? Or you drive them?
Hitch.
Okay, I know what kind they are. They're kind of like, they got a little curve to them.
Yeah.
But they're not Airstream ones.
Right.
They're not fully curved, but they have a little curve on the top.
To be honest with you, I haven't thought about the curvature that much. Huh. Like, I haven't inspected it.
I can just look at it.
You can look at it, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so you got it set up there?
Yeah. It's intimate and cool, but, you know, I don't do a lot of guests. I'm sort of shy about that.
And you're not living in the trailer.
No, I'm not living. Although people think I am. It might come to that. So I have it if it does come to that. I'm ready.
Yeah.
And it might, yeah. But here's the thing. So I started doing it.
That's what I'm thinking of. Yeah. It's got a little curve on the back to it.
Yeah,
you know,
mine's
like
yellow.
Okay, yeah, like this kind of thing?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, that's cool.
But so when I do it, and you can help me with this, I'll sit there and talk to myself for an hour, which is really, that's borderline. You're going crazy.
No, well, that's the big trick, man.
Yeah.
That was the big shift for me is can you sit on a mic by yourself? I mean, that really separates the men from the boys.
Right.
in broadcasting.
Uh-huh.
Can you be compelling by yourself on a mic, you know, alone?
For an hour.
Sure.
For
well, I mean, you've decided that.
But he, oh, okay, right. And here's the thing. So I do it, and yeah. I go, that was great. And then I go back and listen. I go, I can't believe how uninteresting I am. Like, in the moment.
So it's finally you've realized.
I have. All these years. I thought I deserved more in this business. I've come to realize I really don't. I'm where I should be.
Oh, come on. Your stand-up's always strong.
Thanks.
Yeah. But so do you find, what have you found from doing the podcast? I mean, like, do people listen to it? Maybe you shouldn't listen to yourself.
I think what I treat it as is sort of like a companion piece for my stand-up.
Uh-huh.
So if you enjoy my stand-up, this is me sort of dissecting it. I think it's too serious.
Oh, so you're doing what do you call it? Commentary on your bits?
Sometimes I am, and sometimes it's on the world. Sometimes it's on crazy stories.
Do you play the bit and then do
sometimes I do, yeah. Why does this amuse you so much? Sometimes I have to break down something that went wrong or, you know.
And that's what you're doing? So you really...
No, that isn't the theme of the podcast.
No, I get it. But what's funny to me is that it's like... it's just so up your own ass in a way, right? Not in a bad way, but I mean, but like, you know, what you're doing when you sort of sit there with your own bit and talk about the bit and where the bit comes from, it's your own bubble.
You might be right. It might be why no one's listening. I don't know. I'm open to criticism for sure. Here's what I've figured out or deduced in life. I'm good at one thing, according to me.
Is that true?
Stand-up comedy. Yeah. That's it.
Is it?
Yes. I believe that's all I'm capable of.
I don't know. I don't know if I agree with you. I it might be all you do. I'm the same way. I mean, that's the thing I do.
Right.
But I imagine I'm capable of other things. You're a bright guy, and you know you get.
I don't know. I've tried a lot of other things.
Like
and
what?
Whether it's creating shows, whether
what
it's
happened?
Even relationships. Uh-huh. I'm good. Stand up. I'm in control. I feel good. And so why not? Why not discuss this on the podcast? It's the only thing I can give the world. Is an explanation for what I'm doing up there. But that's not the theme of the pod.
Right.
I love you so much. I knew you'd find something. What are we, 5 minutes in? The whole way. Like this morning, I'm like, I better find an outfit that's not going to upset Mark.
But
I don't want to trigger him. I don't want to upset him.
Well, I was wondering what you were thinking coming over here. And I was like, sort of like, do you have anything you need to address?
We'll get to it in a second, but let me finish this. When I initially created the podcast, What's Wrong with Orny Adams, I was going out on the road.
Was this before the problem with Jon Stewart?
Did I have a problem with Jon Stewart?
No. His show is called The Problem with Jon Stewart. And you both seem to be in your own echo chamber around your work. So
you know,
good.
Sometimes I discuss John's bits on my show too, and I break them down.
Yeah,
I do.
Do you?
No, I don't. I don't.
Yeah, that would mean you'd have to listen to him.
Yeah. I didn't even know he had a podcast.
It's a TV show. It was on fucking HBO. I don't know if it's still on.
Yeah.
No one knew. He's one of us now. He's just walking among the, you know, marginally well-known mortals.
Happens fast. Happens fast.
Well, he chose to try to come back.
Right.
Like, you know, why not go out a myth?
Yeah.
Why come back and have people go like, oh my God, what happened to that guy?
Right. You got to do sort of like Letterman, but Letterman's sort of tiptoed back.
But Letterman's just sort of an old, beautiful soul now.
Yeah.
You know, John's
doing interviews outside.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. He's a sweetheart. Yeah. Well, it's fortunate that you never got huge because.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I think. I wouldn't be able to handle it.
Oh, gosh.
I wouldn't be able to handle
it. You could barely handle almost getting huge.
Barely huge. I can barely handle barely huge. Yeah.
Okay. So what were you saying?
So I was going out on the road and I was recording really interesting conversations.
Yeah.
And this is how long. It would be like I would talk to drivers and they always had interesting stories. Like sometimes they were coke dealers before they became drivers.
Sure. Yeah.
Some of them have been arrested in jail, accused of murder.
Yeah.
And I'd sort of start talking to them and I had my Zoom just like you. And I said, can I record this?
Mm.
And then I would turn it into like these lofty sort of, I thought I was like NPR bits. I'd do like interstitials in between.
Oh, yeah. Like
it was at this moment, Sean realized, come on, you don't think this is going to be a hit?
No, I mean, you tried stuff. There's nothing wrong with trying stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But you were doing it seriously, earnestly?
Yes, I was. I was. And it would take months to edit and then have music made for it. I mean, I pumped a lot of money into it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
It reminds me of the process of you writing in that old movie. You know, like, that's how you approach everything.
Yeah. Well, here's the good news.
Yeah.
It took me barely succeeding, instead of saying failing, barely succeeding at a podcast to respect you, Mark.
Oh, yeah?
That's what it took. I go, this Mark Maron, he did it. God bless him.
You never respected me before.
No, I did. To be honest with you, and we can get back to, I know where you were leading into.
Why would you? Why would you respect me? I was so hard on you and such an asshole to you.
We can discuss. I'll preempt that by saying I have always respected your comedy.
Okay.
I really do.
Well, thank you.
And so get into that, because I want to hear what you have to say about
what? About what?
Our relationship. Oh. Our friendship.
Well, I think, like, what it was like, you know, and was, I think it happened even before, like, I was annoyed by you before comedian. Okay. Like, before the movie.
You were like an early adapter.
Yeah, I was. But it was not, you know, I think when I look at it in retrospect, and I feel bad about it, and I but the thing was, I don't know that because you're sort of, you have a certain amount of fairly, you know, effective, you know, narcissistic blinders up, mm-hmm. that I'm not sure I was really landing any punches when I was being a dick to you.
Yeah.
I think you probably just thought, like, why is that guy being a dick to me?
Yeah, I couldn't figure it out. Like, I remember one time we were at the improv, and I go, look at Mark, you came over to me, and you were so nice to me, and, like, you almost made it through being nice to me, and then you walked away, here's the dismount, I go, he did it, and then you turned around, and you had to say something, who are you imitating now, Bob Dylan? You had to.
Right. Yeah. What must be, what were you wearing?
Yeah, well.
What was it, the hat?
Maybe the hat, maybe. I didn't know you followed my career so closely, the hat phase.
I just remember you in the hat at Montreal. It's not that I follow your career, but like I see you, and the thing of that, it's the same with, you know, Birbiglia, you know, for me, you know, like, there's something that fundamentally annoys me about him. And I can't, I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's me, you know, it's not them, you know, I don't have it, but, you know, I've spent the, you know, years, it's in some ways, you know, honoring my feelings around people, just being a dick to them.
Right. Well, but what I don't understand, yeah. Mark, is why do you feel the need to say it? Like, I think that too. I go, who, well, look at Mark, who does he think he is? John Lennon? But I don't say it. Uh-huh. I think it.
We'd have to figure out how to say it to me.
But I wouldn't want to. That's
really
because, like, we're not like busting ball comics. Like, we're not like
I've gotten more that way with certain people.
Okay.
Well, there's certain people that I have that I could do it with.
Uh-huh.
You know, and they just get a kick out of it.
Yeah.
But it's not my nature. You know, because I'm always a little too vicious.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there are certain guys that I could just bust balls with, and because they, and I'll take it from them. I don't know. They're just like Gottfried. Like, I'd bust Gottfried's balls all the day long.
Right.
Because he just gets a kick out of it. Yeah. But you're not going to get a kick out of it. You're going to take it personally.
No, I at this point, I don't think so.
Why wouldn't you say, you know, who's he think he is, John Lennon? You've never said anything mean to anybody?
Behind your back, I do. Oh, the minute you leave, I call, you know, I call my crew, and I go, yeah, I got a Marin update. Yeah, now I've upset him by my hat.
Yeah. Tell me about your crew.
I got a crew. Don't mess with my crew.
You got a crew?
Yeah.
Do you? How many guys in the crew?
Between all of us, we have 1,000 listeners on all our podcasts. That's my crew.
Get the Ernie Adams crew?
Yeah. No, we all have our friends that we call after the Friday second show set where the audience sucks and nobody shows up.
You do? You call people?
I used to. I don't anymore.
Mm. If I have a woman in my life, I'll give it to them.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, I kind of, you know, it's weird, the club life, but okay.
Do you find that the women get it?
That
you
what?
Did, when you complain about stand-up, and I'll tell you why.
I don't, you know, I'm only recently getting, you know, sort of more adept at, you know, properly empathizing for women, especially the ones I've been with, you know, because I've not been the greatest guy in the world. But as I get older and as I learn more things, I've gotten much better, and I can see them as separate human beings and not just receptacles for my garbage.
Sure.
So whether they get it or not, I think they get struggle, and most of the time I would say for the last decade or so, I'm generally with fans.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
You want to be loved, and that's the most
I guess I kind of want to be loved, but I like to be appreciated.
Right.
And also there's a shorthand to that because they know a lot about me.
Right.
But it's a good way to lose fans, too.
Yeah, one at a time. But you have plenty to lose. You have plenty to lose. But I see that as a liability when they adore you. Mm. I'd rather be with somebody that knows nothing about comedy, doesn't care about comedy. Uh-huh. Well, God forbid they bring up another comedian I can't stand and they think they're funny.
Uh-huh.
That's a nightmare.
Yeah, well, I have a problem with that sometimes. Yeah,
right.
It's not a nightmare, but I'll be like, really? Orny Adams?
Yeah, tell me why... Why you're an early adapter of being annoyed by? Because I feel like there may be other people out there like you, but I think I divide.
There are. There's my boys, my crew.
Your crew? who's in that crew?
There's a lot of us, man.
Okay. The Largo? I'm sure the talk at Largo
is Largo. Listen to you. You've played there, haven't you?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you do fine there.
Yeah.
What's the problem with the Largo? Why do you think that's a separate
world? I'd love to do Largo. Nobody's asked me.
Oh.
Yeah. I don't. Here's the truth. I'm shocked I'm here right now. Can you explain to me what I'm doing on your podcast?
I wanted to connect. I've been hard on you.
Yeah.
And I knew that, like, no matter how fucking hard I've been on you, for no real reason other than you annoy me, given the opportunity, you would come over here in a second.
Yeah. Well, I did have a conversation with my agents. I'm like, is this a setup? They go, we don't think he does that to people, otherwise he wouldn't get guests.
Oh, yeah.
But I also feel like there comes a point in your life, like, uh-huh. I feel like as you mature, we're not as competitive as we once were.
That's probably true.
You're more welcoming, and we're probably more similar than dissimilar. So when you looked at Orny Adams in a hat, you said, God damn it, that's me.
I think that's true, and that's why I just texted my, when I was talking to my producer, like, that usually is why. I mean, I understand we probably grew up similarly, we're probably sort of, there's some sort of scramble to kind of put ourselves together in a way, something's missing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and I think I identified your quest for selfhood, through whatever means you had, whether it be hats or, acting like other people or whatever, as something I understood.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was going through a sort of a dark period, and so that's where that whole sort of...
When was the dark period?
This was after...
Comedian?
Yes, exactly.
Well, let's go back, because I think the first time I started, like, the first conversations I remember having about you, really... You started at the same time as my ex-wife, really. You guys were contemporaries, you and Mishna,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And you used to do shows together, I think, when you were starting out in New York.
New York, no.
Oh, really?
No.
But she was always sort of like, he's all right. And I'm like, is he?
Did I lead to the breakup of your marriage?
Oh, no,
please
no,
tell
no,
me
no,
it was
no.
over me.
Oh, no, I did that.
She liked
I
me.
Did, yeah. No, I led to the breakup of my marriage.
Yeah.
But it was one of those things, like you're talking about, like, she was like, okay with you. And I'm because you guys were contemporaries. Yeah. And I was like, that guy's annoying. Who's he think he is? You had this, like, this swagger, this cockiness mm-hmm. that I'm sure I had, but mine was angry. Right. Yours was just sort of like, of course I'm here. Why wouldn't everybody love me? And I was like, you can all go fuck yourselves. You don't get it. It's a different approach, but uh-huh. similar roots, I think.
Yeah.
Where'd you come from?
Boston.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you grew up in Boston?
I grew up outside in a town called Lexington, Massachusetts.
I know Lexington, yeah.
Birthplace of American liberty.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And you?
We'd watch the revolution, the reenactment of the revolution every April.
You were born in Lexington?
Yeah.
Huh.
Born and raised.
Wait, I'm trying to remember, because there was, like, I started my stand-up career doing one-nighters in New England, so I'm trying to remember if there was one in Lexington.
Never in Lexington. No way. No liquor license.
You'd be surprised. Oh, is that true?
Oh, there might have been, like, a grill. Right. There was, like, a place where you throw popcorn on the floor.
Right.
That chain.
You mean, like, peanuts on the floor?
There was that sort of
Yeah. Well, those
buffoonery.
Are the kind of places.
That's
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So you grew up in, like, what was your father doing?
My father, and I don't talk very much about my family. I'm very sort of private, which is another reason why.
Is it private, or you just like to talk about yourself?
No, I just feel like I want to protect them. It's none of their business that I went into this.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No, my dad was worked for Polaroid my entire life. I was always around cameras.
Yeah.
And then he left Polaroid and started a company doing focus groups for juries, big cases.
Really? What a weird job transition.
No, because at Polaroid, he was doing marketing research for that. So that was his skill set. And my mom, a kindergarten teacher.
Wow. So you were like, this noise is a big part of your childhood. Like,
I love it.
And just like, they're coming out. The SX-70, that must have been a big day at your house.
Well, you know, like your family where they're like, Mark, stop taking pictures. It's a dollar a picture.
Oh, right.
Right. We had piles of film everywhere, you know.
It's a dollar a picture. Were they good pictures?
No.
They were of themselves. They were, it was a thing.
Well, let me explain to you. There was a time that we didn't have digital instant photography right on our phones.
Sure.
So the excitement of watching something come into focus.
Yeah.
Was really cool. And my dad was fascinated by the chemistry behind how Land, the guy who started Polaroid, figured out how in one sheet that came out of a camera, this thing took the picture and developed.
Yeah.
The technology blew him away.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And then artists picked up on it, and there was ways, like if you had the old ones, if you had the ones before the SX-70, you could kind of manipulate the surface on them with a pen or a pencil before you peeled off the thing.
Right.
I remember them from when I was a very young kid, because I'm older than you, but not by much. But I remember my grandparents had one of the Land cameras where you had to pull the whole piece out and kind of wait with it for like 2 or 3 minutes, I think, before you peeled the gunk off.
Probably and then, black and white too, right?
There were some black and white ones, and then that stinky gunk that was on there, you had to throw that away because it was toxic. And when you're a kid, you always wonder, what's in the little squirty pack inside the process, you know?
Right.
But it was nasty. But those pictures were kind of cool, and they were kind of groovy by the time I was in high school. If you could get hold of one, it was kind of cool and arty to have one.
And Warhol, I was watching that documentary, you know, he would take pictures with a Polaroid, then he would, you know, turn it into a screen on a shirt and paint it. And,
right, the silk screen,
yeah.
So you have brothers and sisters?
Two sisters.
Older?
I'm in the middle.
You're in the middle?
And they're all, you know, my entire family is... I call them normal. They all live within a mile or two of each other.
Oh, that's nice.
In Lexington.
They got kids, the
they
sisters?
They have kids. I have nieces. I have nephews.
Oh, yeah.
I don't, you know, it's, and they're together all the time.
You get along with them?
I do.
Huh.
I talk to them, you know, like my dad, we were going back and forth watching the tennis, you know, Wimbledon today. Yeah. I talk to my family every day.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's nice. And your mom is a kindergarten teacher. She doesn't teach anymore, does she?
No.
Oh.
Everyone's retired and bored.
Are they?
They're so bored. They're like, please drop the grandkids off.
Really? That's that's what they do. Well, that's nice for the sisters to have all that.
And unlike me, they're very social.
So when did you, like when you were a kid in this well-adjusted Jewish family?
Sure.
You'd be bar mitzvah and everything?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, very,
yeah,
not religious, but very into the faith.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, in what way? Ritual?
Yeah, I mean, I think socially too. Like
sure,
we were always at the temple. We had Jewish friends.
Yeah. Hebrew school friends?
Yeah.
You still got them?
College friends, I do.
Oh, no Hebrew school friends?
Some of them, but I'm not as connected. I didn't love, I still, like, I've got to do a show next week and I have to wear a suit, and it drives me nuts. It reminds me of get your suit on and get to temple. I remember there was 1 week, either I grew or
one suit.
Yeah, I ate too much and it was tight. And now that's my biggest fear every time I get into a suit.
Oh, yeah?
Is it going to be tight?
Well, I think that's another thing we have in common is food issues and body dysmorphia.
Absolutely.
You're a vain motherfucker.
No, I have a Jewish metabolism.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Where was the input? Was there food in the house? I mean, is there somebody?
Of course there's food in the house.
But you come from a healthy eating family?
No. Mm. I mean, I don't think in particular, but they're always food's always ready to go. Like during the pandemic, I flew home like right at the beginning, like in the 2020s. I was going to miss my first Thanksgiving ever, which was mandatory.
Yeah.
So
at your folks' house.
Yeah. So I flew to Boston with three masks on and with the spray. And everything, and I rented a car, and I didn't tell anybody because I didn't want them to be worried about me flying. This is before the vaccine. This is before we even knew what it was.
Yeah.
And I flew home, and I called my parents from the front yard, and I said, "What's for dinner?" And they said, we're having fish. I go, I don't want fish. I want brisket. They go, oh, we wish you were here. I said, open the front door. And my mom almost passed out. My dad had to catch her. She burst out crying. And I drove to my... She goes, go surprise your sisters. Yeah. I did it at my sister's houses too.
Same thing.
By the time I came home, she had a full brisket dinner with all the accoutrements and everything just ready to go.
Oh, nice.
And that's what I grew up
with. Yeah. She could cook. That's nice.
But what's interesting is, and I don't know if you felt this way, I felt uncomfortable. My legal name is different than the name that I've...
What is it?
It was Orenstein, Adam Orenstein.
Oh.
And I changed it to Orny Adams... Because why does this make you laugh again? You hate every
How is that not funny to hear someone's real Jewish name?
What we're missing is the
what?
Without video, the passive aggressivity.
It's not passive aggressive. How is that not funny? That's what am I supposed to just take like from Orenstein, you get Orny Adams and be like, oh, okay.
But I'm trying to create a tender moment for us.
It is.
So I didn't like is her real name Marin or is it Marin Witz?
No.
Was it ever changed?
No.
Huh.
It's weird. It goes all the way back, too. I did that show, Finding Your Roots. It goes all the way back to fucking Belarus in the 1800s, Marin.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I didn't like that I was immediately identifiable as being Jewish.
Of course. I mean, I understand that. Jeff Lifschultz, John Leibowitz. I forget what Jerry Lewis's real name. It's not unusual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But now I kind of want to be identified as Jewish.
Well, maybe you should change your name and make that the topic of your podcast.
What about Orny Marin? What do you think of that?
That's my biggest nightmare. we'll call this episode of the podcast that. Orny Marin. So you want to change it back to what is it? Adam Orenstein?
What's I wouldn't change name? It back, but I don't.
What's your first name?
Adam. It was Adam. Adam Orenstein became Orny Adam.
Well, that was a clever switch.
Yeah.
Now, what does your mom call you?
Adam. Or Boychuk.
Boychuk, really?
Boychuk.
So you had grandparents that were first-generation immigrant kind of thing?
I think they were second.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Were they in Massachusetts, too?
Massachusetts, yeah.
We went to Boston Jews, man.
The best, right?
I used to work at a deli one year in West Roxbury called Gordon's Deli. And I didn't realize that there was, just those old generation of Boston Jews who were immigrants, just like in New York. You always identify it with New York, but it's a whole different culture.
Yeah.
There's four different kinds of rye bread in Massachusetts.
The ones with seeds, the one without seeds.
There's Sisal rye with the seeds.
Yep.
There's light rye, which is light rye. There's dark rye, which is dark rye. And there's pumpernickel.
Yeah.
Four. I had four at the fucking store. We had tongue, we had brisket. It was real old-timey
shit.
This must
have pissed you off.
Huh?
Four different kinds.
No, it was fine. It was like a new education. It was just a way of phrasing.
Where'd you grow up?
New Mexico. From Jersey. My family's from Jersey.
Why are we in New Mexico? Does somebody have allergies?
No, my dad, he was in the service when he did his residency as a doctor, and he wanted to start a practice, and he had a friend who had moved to Albuquerque, and it was a growing city. So he was like, let's do it there.
What kind of doctor was
orthopedic.
Oh.
Surgeon.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'm having knee surgery this month.
Yeah, hammers and nails, buddy. Hammers and saws. Hammers
I'm ready. Is he still practicing?
No.
He's
still in Albuquerque. He's slowly losing his mind.
Yeah.
But both your parents are healthy?
Yeah.
So when do you start?
How about yours? Both healthy?
Well, my dad's got he's starting to lose it a little bit. My mom is dizzy. But she's okay.
Okay.
I don't know.
How wonderful that they're still alive and still married? Or
no, not married. Still married. No, yeah. They're all right. They're old. My dad's 83. My mom's 80, I think. How old are your parents?
Right there, 80. Yeah. My dad's about 80.
And he's got his marbles.
Yeah, for the most part.
That's good.
Sure. I mean, some days he's really with it.
Yeah.
You know, other days.
Sure.
I feel like depends. I guess what time I call.
Yeah. Well, that's true.
Yeah.
So when do you start?
But I do
realizing.
Feel so lucky that my parents are alive.
It seems like they must have. It seems like you grew up with everything you needed, and
sure,
you were the boy. Were you always thought of as the golden one?
No, not even close.
All right.
No, my family they would pick on me nonstop.
Really?
But that's
in
my family. It's just my family would laugh when we get together. We laugh.
Yeah.
We were the family in the restaurant that people were like, "What's going on over there?"
Yeah.
and could they be quieter?
Yeah.
So anything, you know, like when I graduated from college and I had a resume and I had a cover letter and I sent it out to about 100 different corporations looking for a job.
What'd you study?
Political science and philosophy.
Well, so what kind of jobs were you looking at?
I can't remember. I actually think I was looking for advertising, doing copywriting.
So when you were in high school and stuff, you never did any performing of any kind?
No, just in college. But I sent out this letter and the final line, instead of thank you for your consideration, the typo was thank you for your consideration. So now every time we get together, you know, it's, you know, can you pass the turkey at the thank you for your consideration. Yeah, so it's like, you know, I'm still being mocked for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Still. Wild.
And I never got a job. I never got a job offer. I've only lived off of stand-up comedy.
Well, okay. So you go to high school, no performing.
I played a Rolling Stones song in like a talent show.
You play guitar?
No, I'm horrible.
Oh, but you used to.
No, I was horrible.
Oh,
but I tried. Here's a beautiful guitar.
That seems to be a theme.
Hey, now that we're bros, you can bust balls all you want.
Thank God, I've been waiting my whole life for
this. Are we going to be friendlier to each other when we see each other at the clubs?
No.
We're going to revert back to awkward in the green room?
It'll be better.
This is like a first step?
Okay. You're so persistent. That's the
I want to be your friend, Mark.
No.
I don't want to be your friend.
You could be like the other fellas, you know, that I see, you know, not be mean to.
Okay.
The thing I can't, like...
Feel bad when you're mean to somebody? Like, do you go home like an addict and go, why did I do that? Or are you a sociopath and lack empathy?
No, I don't lack empathy. I do feel bad sometimes, you know, and I always feel a little bad.
Uh-huh.
But I also try to ride a line and there's not many people I bully anymore. You just happen to be one of them, but I don't do it that much anymore. I just give you stink eye and fucking, you know, and don't engage with you.
Right. I don't think you've bullied me in a long time.
No, I haven't.
And by the way, I'm pro bully. I was bullied in high school and I think it makes you a stronger person.
It doesn't. It doesn't.
Doesn't?
No, it doesn't. I don't think so. I think what it does is make you doubt your own vulnerability. And, you know, if somebody bullies you and they hurt your feelings, it may make you more resistant, but I don't think it makes you feel good about your feelings.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I don't know. I feel like I felt like I was bullied many times in my life.
Really? When?
And I think it...
In high school?
High school, I was...
For what? Were you fat?
No, you just sort of got picked on. Like, I don't think there's anything specific.
So
but
this
it's
is
not
something
like,
that...
It's not like bullied. I was, wait, was like, much like... Is, well, go ahead.
This has happened your whole life.
No, it hasn't, Mark. Don't make excuses for
you've been annoying people since you were a child.
No. And you don't think, what's funny is you're deflecting on how annoying you are.
Sure. I think I'm intense. I don't know if I'm annoying. I wonder if I'm annoying. I think I'm a little too intense and sometimes intimidating and I come off as arrogant, but I don't know if I'm annoying.
Arrogant, yes. I don't think you certainly didn't intimidate me.
Of course not.
But I was more like...
What's wrong with this guy?
Yeah. Sort of like, why is he... He almost got away from the conversation without insulting me.
Yeah, I get it.
And, I mean, let's be honest. Mm. 20 years ago, this meeting would not have happened today.
I know it wouldn't. There was no podcast.
So we've matured. We've matured.
I don't know that it would have gone any differently 20 years ago. And I think... I think that there is something to competitiveness... That is probably part of it. I think that there was probably, you know, outside, you know, my own insecurity and, you know, the jealousy of the type of attention you were getting at a different time, because we're close enough to being contemporaries that I don't look at you as like the next generation or anything. But, you know, there was certainly a period there where, you know, you seemed to be getting a tremendous amount of attention. And then it just... You just self-immolated somehow. It all blew up.
Is that what happened?
I don't know. What happened?
Well, as an outsider, I'd love to hear what you think. Yeah.
Well, I'll be honest with you. Like that, I don't know that I saw the movie until later. Like I didn't see it when it came out. Mm-hmm. But I do remember reading that piece in Harper's
the 6 minutes of funny.
That's interesting. You read that.
I've read it many times.
Why is that? I haven't. Maybe I should discuss this on my podcast.
I've given
bring it
to
down.
People.
Yeah, have you really? Why?
Because it was such an amazing sort of odd insight into what you were going through. You know, more so to me than the movie. Mm-hmm. There's a line, and I think it sort of honors something about comics, but also it's sort of about, you know, kind of the momentum you were in. Mm-hmm. You know, that you're sort of like you were being fueled by this confidence because you were being indulged by the business and by, you know, powerful people.
Right.
had sort of like gotten behind you. And, you know, why wouldn't your ego be, you know, huge?
Yeah.
and ready to go? But that line where you don't do well on stage and then you get off stage, and the I think the final line of the article is by the time he had gotten to the bottom of the stairs, he had convinced himself that he killed.
I don't think I did. I knew I didn't do well. Yes, you love it. You love it. Listen, that guy that wrote that.
Wasn't it a woman?
It was a guy. That guy followed me around and was my best friend.
Yeah, you can't trust him.
You can't. He was irresponsible. And to the point where he called me, the first call in Montreal, I was like, your name is everywhere in the papers. Everyone's talking about you.
Yeah.
Your ego must be huge.
Yeah.
I said, to be funny, I'm going to need a bigger hotel room for it. That's line one of the article.
That's funny.
But he said, Orny's ego's so big, he said he's going to need a big. That's not what happened. I didn't volunteer this information. I was reacting
to
it.
But it was a joke, yeah.
It was a joke. It doesn't come across as a joke. It comes across as fodder for pricks like you that are looking to, you know, take me down to the fact you're like, everybody I'm possibly having a deal with, you send them the Harper's article.
My first demo reel from
Atlanta.
Oh, no. It was comics. I just thought it was a well-written thing about comedy, about
the
experience.
Way out of my league in that thing. I didn't know what I was in for. I didn't know, you know.
Well, let's talk about where it unfolded. Where did you start doing comedy? In college?
Atlanta, Georgia, Funny Bone.
Really?
Buckhead was the first time I was on stage.
In Buckhead?
Yes.
I just did a show in Buckhead Buckhead Theater.
It was fine.
So why there? You were going to school there?
Yeah, I was going to school there.
Oh, Emory.
Yeah.
How was that? What did you do that first time?
I did. I'd have to look at my set list. I still have it. Yeah, I do.
Wow.
I do. I was doing jokes about studying abroad in Italy. I wasn't 21 yet. So
how'd it go? The set.
I felt very comfortable up there, but I'm sure, who knows? In fact, this weekend, for July 4th, one of the parties was my college friends, and one of them was there that night.
Wow.
The first time I did comedy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Did you do it for them in the dorm room before?
I was always sort of funny, and when I studied abroad in Italy, in fact, that might be the first time I did stand up. I did it for all the American kids, like in the in the general assembly room.
Yeah,
and then I would go to Boston over the summer and do stand up, and it was
where at?
Knicks, Stitches, Catch a
Rising
Star.
This is like while you're in college.
Yes.
Oh, so Catch was still open.
Knicks. What else was it? Giggles and Saugus.
Giggles and Saugus. Yeah, the Leaning Tower of Pizza.
Yeah, I would do all
Knicks at the Kowloon.
You know, I never had to do an open mic or a bringer
show.
Dick Doherty's, because there was just so many rooms.
Right, but you had enough. You had enough chops that. Well, back then it was sort of before bringer shows. It was still sort of an open mic guest spot situation. So you were what, doing opening slots and stuff?
No, it would be like, you know, it's Don Gavin's show Wednesday night at Knicks.
And, right.
You know,
so you were getting booked.
I was getting booked
because
on those
shows. You had the bits.
Well, I think in those days you would come up and say, "Hey, I'm a stand-up comedian from Atlanta."
They try it.
You'd embellish, right? You're doing stand-up down there. You come up here.
So you didn't present yourself as a local.
Well, I was a Boston boy and always will be, but
Mike Clark would give you a shot.
Yes.
Yeah.
And if you deliver.
You get the gig.
You get
and
the
then
gig.
They'd start folding you into those one-nighters and going to Saugus.
For $75 to go to New Hampshire.
$75, that's right.
Loved it. That's how you cut your teeth, right?
That's how I did it. I mean, it's not how everybody does it, but I cut my teeth in New England doing one-nighters.
But don't you think that's what makes you better? Like,
absolutely.
When anybody says, what advice would you give a young comic? Get on stage every single night.
Well, that's one thing, but I mean, you know, but doing it that way where you go up cold opening for another guy in the middle of nowhere, I mean, that's different.
Right.
I mean, that really is hard.
But don't you remember the days when, like, you got booked as a feature and now you have to do 30 minutes, but you don't have 30 minutes, so you sit there, you write out a list.
You do everything, yeah.
Yeah, for 30 minutes you're on stage going, now go to this bit, now go to this bit.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, but like when I started, it was mostly two-man show, so it wasn't a feature spot. The opener had to do a half hour, and then the headliner would do 45 minutes.
Huh.
That was the one-nighter thing. And the Good Places had an opener. Like if you did Giggles or you did the Taunton Regency, a three-man show. But most of them, in my recollection, were two-man shows.
Well, I remember in Boston, the MC on the weekday shows was the headliner. So it'd be
Sweeney. Yeah. That's right.
And so those guys would get up there. They'd do 45 minutes if they wanted to. Then they'd bring me up or they'd bring somebody else up. Right. And it was all
Lenny
really...
Lenny and
strong comics. So you were around strong comedy
What years were that?
91 to, you know, up to the 2000s. You know, I moved to New York for about 4 or 5 years.
So you started really doing the work at the clubs in Boston, so you didn't have to do bringer shows, but it's still a little before bringer shows, I think.
Yeah, I didn't do bringer, or there were no open mics either. I never like waited in a line, I never saw
I did some of that.
I got lucky.
I definitely did open mics at Catch a Rising Star.
Huh.
And played against Sam's. Yeah, definitely, there was definitely open mics. But, so that was your entrance. So when did you move to New York?
Well, what happened was Disney came in and they were scouting to give development deals.
Oh.
And they saw me and they flew me to LA for a meeting with the head of development for Disney.
Yeah.
And I remember that meeting. It was me and one other kid who's probably no longer in the business. They put us up at a really nice hotel and we had our meetings. And they said, you're going to meet with her and you're going to talk for like 20 minutes. And then you'd sit outside of the office and they'd say, we're going to let you know if you're going to stay in LA or you're going to go home on a plane.
Yeah.
And I got sent home on a plane that night. I got like eliminated from the deal. And it was the longest, saddest flight. This is before cell phones. You couldn't even call your parents and go, no, I got sent home.
Yeah.
Like it happened so fast. They got me the hell out of that hotel room.
Wow.
And but after.
Welcome to show business.
Yeah. I should have known then to get out. And then after that, people wanted to see me do stand up. So I'd go to New York to audition.
Yeah.
And so I'd do a set at the Cellar so they could see me, stand up New York, blah, blah. And that's how I got in at the Strip at all those clubs was because of that.
Okay.
So
for
that,
showcases.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that was fortunate.
And then you moved down there.
Loved it. I would say as a stand-up comedian, the most pure point in my career was doing
15-minute sets
all over town with the best.
Yeah.
With the best.
Sure.
And just, you know, nobody was thinking, am I talking about something that could become a TV show? Nobody was thinking, am I wearing something that says something?
Yeah.
We were just getting up there to be funny. Boston, too, was like that.
So you're doing New York. And how many Lettermans did you do?
I did one Letterman.
Mm.
I did a few Tonight shows.
Okay, so what happens now? Let's just track what I'm trying to track. And what I was going to say to you before about people I resent and what I've realized, you know, and I always kind of knew, is that no matter how much, you know, I may be annoyed with you for my own dumb reasons, you know, you're a good comic and you're solid and you always do the job. So, like, no matter what I think, you know, that, you know, stands out to me. And, you know, and I have to honor that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like you're not like a hack and you're not like you're the aggravated guy. I get it. You've been that way since you were young. I don't know why. You acted like you were 70 when you were 30.
Well, but why does it matter why?
It doesn't matter.
I do it, yeah. And it's mutual. I've always respected your work and I've always thought you were funny. And that never, like, which kind of sucks because you just want to go, this guy's a dick and he's a hack.
I know.
But I could never, you know.
Say I'm a dick.
Because I like you and I want to like you and it's strange when someone you admire is attacking you.
I know. Well, you know, I'm sorry about that.
And I'm sorry that I annoyed you with my annoyingness.
It's not your fault. You're who you are. You know, no one was inviting me to parties.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I definitely annoy some people. When does this, the momentum start? You know, that was, how do you frame that whole experience with comedian, with a movie and what happened after
I can tell you the way I remember it in my brain is I was doing a lot of shows in the city. I was, every night I'd go Cellar, Gotham, stand up, strip, back down to the Cellar. This is like 1990.
Okay.
Yeah. And I felt like like they were making accommodations. Like if I called Essie and go, can I go one set later so I can do stand up New York? She would do it. And I felt very good about myself. And they would put me on, you know, stand up New York to close the show, Gotham to close the show. And all of a sudden.
Yeah, that's why. That's probably the beginning of why you were annoying me. Is that because I was there, wasn't I?
Yeah.
I was in New York.
Right.
And I, okay. Yeah.
So what annoys you about that?
Well, it was just sort of like, you know, you represented something that annoyed me. You were just a guy that was, you know, going out to kill at all the clubs, and you know, you didn't the ambition of it. I'm just weird about it. You know, and it's a problem I have. I probably have to explore more. But you know, people who are focused and specifically ambitious and aware of it annoy me.
Yeah.
Like, I know I'm ambitious, but I don't pay attention to it. So it's just a persistence that
I
have.
So let me ask you a question. Do you like athletes like Muhammad Ali that, you know, I'm a bad man or whatever he says, I sting like the cocky.
Sure,
you do.
Yeah.
Do you like the guy in baseball that points the right field and then knocks it out of the park?
Kind of.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a sports guy.
I love those guys.
I know. Okay, I get
it. Do you see where I'm getting at?
No, like, I get it. Yeah, and maybe it's because I don't really watch sports that I just misunderstood you for so many years.
Right. That's what it is?
Yeah, he's just a guy that wanted to hit it out of the park.
Yeah.
He wants to, you know, float like a butterfly and sting like a bee.
I think it's interesting that you can get away with these things.
I can't even manufacture the confidence that you were manufacturing either for real or out of insecurity at the time you were doing it, and I found it contemptible.
Huh. And I respect that. And okay. I agree. And looking back, yeah, there are many things that I look and I'm embarrassed. It makes me cringe.
Like what?
Mark, there's a million.
The movie?
Yeah, there are parts of the movie. I understand.
Okay, let's go back to the beginning of the movie. So you're doing all these sets.
Yes.
And what happens?
Every time I saw that stupid camera crew
in
the lobby of any of those clubs, I knew Seinfeld was going to come in.
Okay.
And now bump me.
Right.
And I'm using this as a launching pad for my social life. So New York's a wonderful place. You can do your shows till 1 in the morning, and then you can stay out till 4. You don't have to worry about drinking and driving. You're going to take the subway or cab home. And I would have women show up or friends, and we'd go. Well, you're not quite the hero that night when Seinfeld shows up.
Yeah.
So he kept bumping me from shows.
Yeah.
Understandably. So that one day the film crew saw that I was frustrated, if you can believe it.
Yeah.
And they said, can we ask you a few questions? And I said, sure.
Yeah.
They said, what do you think of Seinfeld's act, the new act? I said, I don't think it's that good. I said, it sort of seems dated. Like, his style seems dated. The topics, he doesn't talk fast enough.
You saying this on camera?
On camera.
Hmm.
They show Seinfeld. Seinfeld says, quote, follow this guy. He's the only one that has the balls to criticize me.
Hmm.
And I was then followed and enamored. Again, these guys, these producers, if you know anything about what's going on in reality shows now, they know how to make you feel good and get you to say shit that you shouldn't say. And I was too young and naive. And I was also doing a character in some sense. So when I go to a car service and I go to open the door and I look at the camera and go, I have to open my own door? That's a character.
That makes sense.
But that isn't when people see it. They go, who does this guy think that he doesn't have to open his own doors?
Yeah.
So
you're kind of playing the part they put you in.
Yes.
Right.
And you know what? There were two versions. There was a version of that film that we took out, or Seinfeld took out, but he graciously took me along for. Seinfeld was very kind to me.
Yeah.
Flew me to New York one time, and he said, I want to take you out and show you how to be famous and sign autographs.
Uh-huh.
He was very, anytime I did when I did a special, he would call and come, like, he privately was very supportive of me. And so then it got sold to Miramax. I remember meeting with Harvey Weinstein.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Huh. How was that?
Everything you would expect it to be.
Okay.
And so once that version, the word came back, take out this guy doing stand-up and take out these moments that make him look human and sort of vilify him. And so that's what they did. The second cut was a lot different than the first one.
So they set you up.
I wouldn't say it was a setup. I would say they're smart. They've got to have a bad person in there. So it's easier to dislike me if you don't see stand-up that substantiates my...
Why'd Jerry let him do that?
Why do you think?
Because it's payback.
Payback for what?
For having the balls to criticize him.
It may be. I don't know. I don't know.
So what was the relationship with George Shapiro who just passed? Because, I mean, that was, you know, that was...
He was my manager.
Right. But so Seinfeld turned him on to you.
I have some thoughts on that I won't share today, but I think
what
it's
do you mean?
Some...
When are you going to share them? This is it.
This is it? Is this my... I have some thoughts on that,
and he's dead.
He's dead, but still, I'm going to wait until everybody's dead, and then, yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to wait until the day before we leave for Mars.
Okay.
And all right. as a species. Yeah.
Okay. So how'd you get involved with George? Through Jerry?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And the producers were sending him my tapes.
So, the producers of the documentary.
Yes.
Where were they from? England?
One was British, but they were both guys that worked at an ad agency and had worked with Seinfeld and pitched this documentary. And I was so excited to get $700 a day,
nothing about you wanting to be involved in that was peculiar. Why wouldn't you?
What I think is fascinating is it's on... Netflix now.
Is it?
It is. I shouldn't have said that, but it is. Why are you laughing? I'll get, people will like on social media, they'll like attack me. They'll be like, just saw the new Seinfeld thing. I'm like, it's not new. It's not even HD.
What a fucking nightmare.
It's a square image. Thank you.
The fucking
but
nightmare.
People attack me. I'm the villain of this. Do you understand Bill Cosby is in this documentary and I'm still the asshole?
Yeah. I'm sorry, buddy.
You love it.
No, I don't. I'm laughing because it's hilarious, but it's horrible. It's just this, you had no control over it. And, you know, you've obviously framed it in retrospect as you can understand why they made the choices you made. But it hobbled you and it's not going to go away.
No. Even when I met Brooke Shields, she said, it's your Blue Lagoon. That's what she said. It's going to come up in every interview, well, at least like you today.
Of course it's going to come up today, but I'm sure it's not coming up that much anymore, is it?
No, I think, like, yeah. I got a... Michael Moore said to me, I went into that documentary, and I came out loving you and hating... you know, the people that were involved with that without naming the name.
They set you up.
So then, okay, thank you. What does that
mean? I'm just saying that, like, you know, you've had to frame it in retrospect. They're like, they needed a villain, they did this, but it's not unlike that article that I enjoyed only because of the last line. You know, because the thing is, like, you know, it hurts me to feel like that I was mean at you or felt any satisfaction. But, you know, I'm just an insecure, angry guy. So what I saw happen at that time was some sort of schadenfreude that, you know, you will be humbled because of you flew too close to the sun.
I think I have been humbled by that.
I definitely think you've been humbled.
Yeah.
But I think that line, by the time you got to the bottom of the stairs, I thought it was a funny line. And it always stuck with
but
me.
But I knew I did not do well in Montreal. And I said something from the stage that still today, this day, just makes me, like, you know, shrivel up. You know, I at Montreal was given every opportunity and I blew it. I blew it.
Well... Look, man, it's a tough gig sometimes. There's a lot of pressure. It's not a real audience. You got half the audience is in industry. Half of them are local. Some of them are drunk. And the new face is a fucking nightmare. Mm-hmm. You know, for anybody to really succeed at that, there has to be, you know, so much expectation. And back then, people were unknown. But I do think that, you know, a guy, you know, in your position who worked hard, who got really liked, you know, really believed in comedy and wanted to do it more than anything. How were you not going to behave the way you behave when you got all that sort of juice from those people?
Right.
You know, I don't think you could have known at the beginning of that, you know, it would hang around your neck like a fucking albatross.
Yeah. Do you think that your opinion of this is the majority in the stand-up community? Like, I feel like I feel like, in a sense, that I alienated myself from some people in the stand-up community.
And well, I think what you're saying, that, you know, as you say to me to my face, that, you know, differentiating between sort of playing into their expectations and actually being who you are, you know, probably is misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I don't know what the general opinion is, but you know how you came off, and half of that is because they cut you to use you as this foil, but also part of it was that you were playing it up.
I agree.
So like people would sort of take that like, well, that guy's like that, mm-hmm. But when you say to me that you were sort of like it was a gag, it makes sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
If this is the position they're going to put me in, why not just fucking like
I felt like, stand-up comedians, we look for a reason to hate other comics. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're watching somebody kill on stage and go, oh, now he's talking about, that hack topic. You know, it's like,
it's just insecure competitiveness.
Yeah. I guess. Yeah. I mean, I feel like I gave everybody the opportunity.
You didn't. You didn't give it to them.
So then why?
They did it to you.
So, have you ever said that publicly? Like, why is it?
Saying it now.
Okay, thank you. Now that my career's over?
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's time.
Appreciate it. Thanks for the boost now. Great. Why you do that? You do that radio thing where you don't laugh into the mic. Like, again.
I don't want to blow the levels up. You can hear me laughing. No, because like it's just... It's a hard thing to come back from because I think I don't know. Like you're not no angel. You're no angel in the sense that you're not. I think you do expect a certain amount of respect, and I think you work hard, and your ethic is good, and you're a guy that kills. So you want to be treated like the guy who kills. Like, I'm the guy who kills every night. Where's my fucking prize?
Well,
what do I got to be out there doing the second show on Friday for half a house?
I thought in this business, and really, screw me for even ever having this crazy thought. But
what?
I thought if you were funny, it led to things, but it isn't that.
Sometimes it just leads to being funny.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Like, you're so zen about that,
No, but I mean, I'm only zen about it in the sense that I know that there is no fairness to it. And a lot of times there's plenty of people that can kill, dude. I mean, it's just the reality of it, especially now there's thousands of comics,
mm-hmm.
And how anybody builds an audience or why people are appealing either on this mic or on the stand-up mic or on a TV show, who the fuck knows? I mean, you can be so proficient and so perfect and do everything right and get exactly the response you want, but still not garner the big following. I don't know why. Mm. I don't know what the fuck that is. Do you know what I mean? And there are comics that sell millions of tickets that some people don't even know. It's a weird thing.
Yeah, it is weird.
It's not a meritocracy.
Are you happy with where your stand-up career?
I've had to make certain acceptance about it. I'm happy with my stand-up career because by some fucking virtue of I don't know what. When I started this podcast, I couldn't sell fucking tickets. And then, like, with the podcast audience developing, they didn't know that I was a comic.
Huh.
Really? They knew I talked about it, but they would come out like, we should go support Mark. I'm like, this is actually the thing I know how to do.
Exactly.
So over time, through one way or another, just by and all because of this, the podcast and the timing of the thing, which was the first time in my life I had good cosmic timing, it all happened on my terms, but I got opportunities and I was ready for them. So, between the acting and the podcast and the stand-up and this and that, I have an audience, but it's not, I'm not filling arenas, but mm-hmm. I can make a living.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's great.
So I've had to accept that because there's always some part of you, man, like as a comic and as somebody like us who are, sort of fundamentally a little insecure and think that we're entitled to more attention than
who
we
are. Who isn't insecure?
There are people that aren't insecure.
There are. Okay. But why do we always have to label comics insecure?
Because a lot of us are.
But I think in the world we're insecure.
No, I get, well, no, I get it. There's insecure plumbers and there's insecure.
God! The way I snaked that toilet, or the I could have snaked the drain better.
I don't think.
Damn it!
Do you see
the way Mark snakes the drain?
I don't think that's true. I think they probably compete.
He's in and out of the house in 30 minutes.
I don't think it's task specific. I think they're more insecure about why
I'm a stupid plumber. Damn it! God, I suck at plumbing.
Why did I commit my life to this?
God,
I work so hard.
I have a boss. I work for a plumbing company.
Well, a lot of them are their own guys, but I think they're more
stupid, insecure plumber. Yeah,
exactly. But I don't think that's true. I think that, you know, unlike, you know, alcoholism or drug addiction, I think that's pervasive with mm-hmm. every type of person. Mm-hmm. But I think insecurity is a fairly common component in what fuels us to do what we do. So, you know, how you manage that and how yeah. bad it fucks you. You know, that's half of your job, mm-hmm. right?
I agree. I'm not denying I'm insecure.
No,
you
know, I know.
But I think it's more, you know, out there. I think everybody's insecure.
Okay.
Just well, where, how do you, where
I used
do
to
you
think that
it?
About bitterness, but I was wrong. and you know, and I spent a lot of my life thinking that people were as aggravated about the things I was aggravated about on an existential level
yeah.
that, you know, they just don't know it. And I'm here to introduce right. them to that. But a lot of times people are just looking at you going like, why is this guy so worked up about this?
Yeah, I know. So, yeah. Like, you ever meet people and they're like seemingly happy in life yeah. and they have nothing? You're like, they have nothing.
Yeah, but
like,
they have
so much more than them, but they're happy. How
do you
are they
know
able
what
to be
you
happy?
Have? What do you have that they might have something you don't have?
No, I've done a full audit.
No, but this is the issue.
Yeah.
Is this assumption, and I think I've done it, and I may have more progress with it mm-hmm. than you do, that we understand or know, you know, what other people are thinking, or that's for some reason, our lives, our stupid fucking lives where we can't manage a relationship, we don't really have many friends, we're insulated, we've never had a fucking job, we sit here around and look at the fucking world and write our stupid little jokes, assuming that we understand people, it's a fallacy. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that have different priorities in their life and what you know determines whether or not their life is fulfilling. And we're in our selfish, dumb worlds where we're sitting around by ourselves trying to make things work out. We think we understand that.
So was it unhealthy for Marc Maron to go into this business?
No.
Would you mentally have been better served doing something else?
Well, you know, Orny, that, you know, once if you've got this thing for real, this bug, mm-hmm. that, you know, there you don't have other options.
Right.
And you can't, no matter, even if you have these fantasies about like, well, maybe I could do this, maybe I could do that, there's just no way it's going to happen. So by the time I started this fucking podcast, I was like, you know, I'm looking at a life of, you know, if this, you know, right now, when I got on that mic, you know, after that second divorce, you know, from Mishna and, you know, going broke and everything else, that, like, I knew that was a moment where I knew exactly who I was. Is that at best, like, I can't sell tickets. So I'm looking at a life of plowing it out, you know, in B comedy rooms as an unknown headliner for life. Mm. That, or I'm going to put a fucking gun in my mouth. Mm. I don't have the courage for that. Okay, so I had to accept, at some level, the limitations and the reality of what my life was. And then I got on these mics and something clicked. Who the fuck knows? Cosmic, I don't know. I was lucky, but I have to assume it had something to do with talent. Mm. But I definitely knew at that moment, and I used to do a joke about it, that, you know, at some point you get so far along where you're like, there's no plan B. There might not have ever been. Right. But, you know, but there's that moment where you're sort of like, hey, if this doesn't work, I could always... Holy fuck.
yeah, there is nothing.
Right.
There is nothing. But also, don't undermine that you had the guts and the courage early on to expose yourself at that level, which I don't. I'm still the guy who, and I wish I wasn't, has to suck my stomach in for every picture that has that concern. And I wish I could just get out there and just not care. And for you to have that courage when you turn the mic on, I think that's, you know, I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I still, like, I care. But, like, the thing is that eventually it's going to catch up with you. And no matter how much you care, you know, time will make a fool out of you.
Right. Yeah, that's a good quote. Yeah. Time is the great equalizer.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm still uncomfortable with, you know, how I look. I just, you know, I was walking around, you know, I'm nuts, you know, around all that stuff still. But like some part of me realizes like, I'm just not going to get these pictures right. I'm never going to be happy with it.
Right. But then there are some people like Philip Seymour Hoffman who like, it's just so attractive how at home or at ease he was with his appearance and his look. And that to me is kind of cool too.
Oh yeah, I envy, you know, people who are comfortably fat.
Yeah. Do you ever think like if you and I had any charisma, how far we would have gone?
I think we both have charisma, But I think we're a little, I think our problem is a self-centeredness more than anything else.
I don't think we're any more self-centered than anybody
else
in this business.
Well, this is your particular problem. You just said you've decided that everyone must be insecure and that now we're not, we're just as self-centered as everybody else.
Well, I don't you think in these times, do you go on social media? It's all about me, 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 me.
I get
everybody's
it. I get
posting
it.
Pictures. It's all self-centered. Well, maybe, the whole maybe world that's just become
okay,
self-centered.
Maybe it's a wrong.
We're just pioneers.
Okay. Look where it's gotten us. You're in a trailer talking to nobody, and
literally, I go, "This is on the verge." I go, "This is what crazy people do. They talk about news articles and all that sort of stuff." Yeah,
but
here's the other.
Maybe
thing.
It's not self-centeredness. It's just this weird assumption. I don't know what it is, but I understand what you're saying because, like, I used to do that a lot. Like, I really believed when I was, you know, less funny and more angry and on stage, like at Luna and stuff, that I was speaking to something that everyone must experience. But you know what, man? There are people that are well-adjusted. There are people that don't prioritize the things that we prioritize. There are people that don't get annoyed in the same way
but
that
even,
we do.
But even if you're talking about what? Here's a ruler in front of me, and you're at Luna, and you're so upset about the why is it only
12 inches?
Why yeah. isn't it 24? Okay. Right? They're going to go, this guy's crazy. But that's the way I feel about X, Y, Z.
Maybe. Maybe they stop at this guy's crazy and I'll just laugh at him.
No.
Yes.
I don't think
so. Well, that's the realization I had. At some point I realized that they might not be laughing with me, but if they're going to laugh at me, I'll take either one.
I would have told you if that was going on. When you go, who are you today? Bob Dylan? I would have said, screw you. They're laughing at you, Maron. They're not laughing with you.
I was laughing at you with your fucking hat.
Maron, you're a hacky ruler bit.
Wow.
Hey, so, whatever happened to Maron with his ruler bit?
Oh, yeah. He really worked that thing to the bone. Couldn't get over with it.
God, can anybody find the quarter inch mark?
Uh-huh. Exactly. So how do you find you recovered from all that shit? I mean, like, you know, the letdown or what, how did you know that things didn't pan out
you
after
know pretty
the movie?
Fast. You know pretty fast. Mark, I was playing a theater in Baltimore opening for Seinfeld.
So he took you on the road.
He took
after me, comedian.
Yes, for a couple of gigs, and then he said that we were too similar, our comedy.
Yeah.
So, but you know, it couldn't have gone better. I did the show in Baltimore, and this is how long ago. By the way, for anybody who's wondering, this thing was shot in 1999 and came out in 2001.
Mm.
So this is a long 22 time.
20 years ago.
Yeah.
21 years.
Yeah. Hold on. Let me do the math on the ruler here.
Okay.
So, do you hate the ruler?
No. Calvin? No, you're good.
So I get. I finished the show,
yeah.
And the next day, my parents came from Boston to see the show, uh-huh. And I go to the train station the next day, take the train back to New York, and I go to the newsstand and I grab a newspaper from every major city, San Francisco, New York, Boston, uh-huh. Blah, blah, Atlanta,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I'm panned in every single one of those reviews. In fact,
for the movie.
In fact, like in a cruel way, like the Hollywood Reporter or Variety, the woman writing the review said that I was bereft of humility and she was rooting for my failure. And I thought that's kind of like, you know, I'm an unknown, you know, guy who's
I understand that. That was cruel, but I for some reason that, you know, that I think that was a feeling that people had about how you were represented in there.
Mm-hmm. And thank you for saying it that way, how I was represented. I do appreciate.
Well, I mean, you've told me that, you know, you were in some ways, you know, playing up to something. So the bereft of humility, I think that is an issue.
Well, you know, also when you have cameras in your face, it gives you a little confidence.
Well, you've got humility now.
I sure do. Yeah. And, you know,
okay, so it happened quick. It
happened very quick. And just sort of like the way the they did a screening in New York City. And I remember when it got up, like none of the comics wanted to talk to me. And I go, oh, we might be in trouble here. But I'm sitting next to Seinfeld during the screening and he's like hitting me in the ribs going, I'm just like that. And yet,
You're talking?
Yeah, like during the movie.
Interesting. Interesting that he saw you as a kindred spirit.
Younger version of him. Mm. And call me the most honest person he's ever met.
Huh. Okay, so none of the comics want to talk to you.
I felt that way. And I could be, again, insecure and reading into it wrong. But no, I mean, but I also never felt like I fit in. Did you ever feel like, I'm not the guy who's hanging out till 3 o'clock in the morning with the comics. I was going home or going out with friends.
I hung out with people.
Yeah, I didn't. Yeah. I didn't. So
you're already a little isolated.
Yeah. I went into comedy because I'm an outsider.
Yeah. Well, I always like the crew of outsiders. I like to eat, too, and I can't sweep that well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just hang out, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so, and how did your career go after that?
It was bad. Mm. Bad.
Yeah.
I couldn't get booked. I remember calling Jerry going, I'm, first of all, I had a deal with CBS?
Yeah, development deal.
Yeah, they pulled out.
And they pulled out after the movie?
Yes, after the Montreal and the movie, yeah. Maybe the movie hadn't been out. They pulled out, and a six-figure deal. And then Warner Brothers gave me a deal.
Yeah.
But I don't think they really wanted to give me a deal. I think it was sort of like a favor deal. I don't know. Maybe they did want to give me a deal.
Was that a six-figure one?
Yeah. And it was late in the season, and I barely got a writer. Nothing ever happened. I couldn't believe
I've had two of those.
Yeah.
Three of them. I had a lot of them.
Yeah. And I couldn't get booked on the road. There's some clubs... I'm not kidding, and maybe my information is wrong, but there are some clubs in this country that still will not book me because I'm difficult from comedian.
Really?
Yeah, and I'll tell you off the air one of them. But I mean, I've proven myself on the road. I'm not.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't be working this long in this business if I was difficult.
No, you just do the job, and you show up. You'll do the radio. You'll do everything.
Love it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not kidding. Like, radio, and again, I not to bring the podcast up again, but I run a lot of bits through the podcast, and they end up on stage.
Yeah, me too.
It's right. So, yeah, you'll be doing the roll-up bit.
Yeah. No, you can have it.
Okay. Next time I'm in front of you, I'm closing with the ruler bit.
You take the ruler bit.
Yeah, yeah.
I got that fucking... I used a lotion with some sunblock in it, and I got it in my eye.
Oh, that's the worst. Why don't they fix that?
I don't know. Maybe that's write that down. It's a good premise.
I used to do it. I did. If you didn't shit on it, I was going to go full on into it. I was going to get up. I was going to start screaming and stomping around.
Did you used to do it?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You're really attentive to the minutia.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now you're all right money-wise and not money-wise, but work-wise?
Yeah.
You do all right?
I do all right.
Good.
Yeah.
And do you talk to Jerry?
No.
Okay.
I don't. And to put it like a button on it, this will stay with me, and this will always be a source of pain in my life, this documentary. And it will be something that I feel like I've got to defend even when I don't have to defend it.
Mm.
I don't know. I've gone through this in my head several times. If at the end of the day, I regret doing it because it is such a large part of my identity now as a comedian, I can't imagine not having it. But if at the end I can see the tally sheet and the column in comedian, sorry, the column not in comedian, I'd love to know where I would have ended up with and without it.
Huh.
I mean, we know with.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder if you were allowed to evolve naturally as opposed to be put in that position with that much attention and have no control over how you were sort of represented. I wonder, I guess it's not helpful in any way to speculate.
I mean, a large part of me feels like it's a gift that I was given this opportunity to be self-reflective and understand.
Well, that's good. That's a good way to handle it.
Yeah, I just don't want to be one of those people that says, "Oh, I'm over it. It's 20 years ago, but it will be with me."
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
it's like these people that lose a limb early on in life. It's much similar.
You lost your career's leg.
My leg. I've been on one leg in comedy now for 20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's been the sustaining thing?
Well, it comes back to that spreadsheet I was talking about with did it help or didn't it help, the documentary. And there's an executive producer, the guy who created Criminal Minds on CBS, Jeff Davis, was creating a new show called Teen Wolf.
Uh-huh.
He saw the documentary, and one day he's driving down Melrose, and he sees my name on the marquee, and he said, "I want to go see if that guy's even funny."
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So he goes in and he said
he knew you from the documentary.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So he goes in and he goes, I was blown away. He goes, I loved you. You were really fun. And he kept coming back over and over again to see my show. And then when he wrote this new show, Teen Wolf, which was on MTV, he wrote the part of Coach for me.
Yeah.
I never auditioned. I'm the only one that my agents, here's a good lesson for people. My agents sent me a script and they said, this starts shooting next week in Atlanta. This guy saw you on stage. He's a fan of yours. He thinks you'd be great for the coach.
Yeah.
I went down the street to the coffee shop. I read it and I said, but so often I read scripts. They don't make sense. This one made perfect. I go, I get it.
Yeah.
It's a well-written, this guy.
And he wrote it for you.
Well, he wrote that part for me, but I understood the whole show.
Oh, good.
It was like a nice love story of high school kids that turn into werewolves and kill each other.
Yeah.
So I said, I love it. I'll accept the part. And my agent said, no, you don't. He's not going to just give you the part. You have to audition. So let me call the casting person and I'll tell them that you're free to audition. I said, hold on. This is true. I said, you call Jeff Davis back because he called my agent and you say, Orny Adams will be in Atlanta next week to shoot the pilot. You don't offer me to audition. The minute I audition, I'm not getting the part.
Yeah.
The casting person is going to give it to one of their friends, whatever. Yeah, yeah. So that's how I got on this show, Teen Wolf. And what I loved about it was, for the first time, I wasn't doing my lines.
Yeah.
I had no responsibility.
Yeah.
I just show up.
Yeah.
And then the fans, unlike stand-up, which our fans can be very critical.
Sure.
They're, you know.
They don't even know your stand-up, the fans from Teen Wolf.
It's like you were saying with your podcast early on. Yeah. People didn't know you were a stand-up. They still don't know I'm a stand-up.
Yeah.
They still don't.
But do they come to the shows?
No! Not enough of them. I mean, they'll follow me. They're confused. Like, if they follow me on TikTok or Instagram, they're like, what's... Oh, I didn't know you did stand-up.
But how many episodes of the show has there been?
We did 100.
Oh, my God.
6 seasons.
What's it on?
Now it's on Paramount Plus. It's been on Hulu. It's been on, I think, Hulu. It's definitely been on Netflix.
So this, you make money in your sleep for this
thing. And it has nothing to do with me. It's a massive hit.
Sure.
I'm a side character, and really the success of my character is because of the writing. It really, they wrote me.
But you're in every episode.
No. That's why I'm a success, because they knew to put me in just enough.
Okay.
I mean, I wish I was in more.
So this has been going on for what, 5, 8 years?
How many? And then we just shot a movie. It's
really?
There's a trilogy that they're putting out.
How big's the part? Good part?
No, it's never good enough for me. No, it's great. It's great. You know, honestly, they brought back so many characters. Over 6 seasons, there were so many characters.
Oh, so this is great. This is like a happy ending to everything.
It's cool. But
you're making a living.
Of course I am. I told you when the mics were off before we started this, I said, Mark, come on.
I'm just thinking of the stand-up, and I knew you did this Teen Wolf, but it's like, that's a living in show business.
Yeah. I'm on a show that went 6 seasons.
Yeah.
That's rare.
Yeah.
And the
fans.
Oh,
I feel better. I'm still going to bust your balls.
You can bust my ball. The fans are nothing but loving. These fans are the nicest.
Well, that's great.
It's cool.
I'm glad you landed on your feet. So what about this special?
So I've had 3, but I just put my latest on YouTube.
Is that's all that you self-produced it and you put it up there?
No, I didn't. It was on Showtime.
Oh, okay.
It's called More Than Loud.
And you got it back?
Yeah, I bought it back.
Oh, good.
That's what I recommend to everybody. Own the tapes. Remember, you like when you study musicians, own the masters.
Sure. I mean, I get mine back. I've got a couple back. Like but I don't know. Is the material still? You don't do anything timely.
Well, no, but I mean, this is only a few years
ago. Okay, all right.
And, you know, really, does a guy going crazy over little things ever get a hold? I don't know.
No, that's true.
Yeah, I mean.
I bet you my special that I did one for more later, I did for Epics, and I got it back. So I think I have that one.
I'm very weird. Like I was telling you, I don't do many podcasts.
Yeah.
I just don't. I'm of the camp where you don't overshare.
Yeah.
And I own this special. I own 3 of my specials, and I've never put them out because I always think, well, I'll get a deal with a streamer and I'll sell them these other specials.
Sure.
And my agent's just put it up on YouTube.
Yeah, it's just over.
Yeah.
The old style. Just get, why not get it out there? see what happens.
Right.
But you're there, you're doing it still, and you're always funny, man. It was, and I'm glad we did this. Thanks for talking.
I agree. I mean, I feel like this was fun.
Good.
And I'm glad I wasn't set up.
Oh, I'm not gonna set you up.
Are we gonna be cool now? Are we?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, that was Orny Adams. Wow, shit, right? I feel bad, but I feel good we talked. He's at the Hollywood Improv this weekend, July 15th and 16th. His podcast is called What's Wrong with Orny Adams. Get that wherever you get podcasts. And look, will you hang out for a second? There's more stuff. Just hang out. Listen, folks, if you're a full Marin subscriber on WTF Plus, we posted this visit that I had with my dad in New Mexico last weekend. And I recorded me going through some stuff, some pictures and stuff. And it was really touching. But it's only available to you full Marin subscriber people. But I'll play a little bit for you. This is my dad recognizing the dogs from his childhood.
Do you remember this dog?
Yep.
You do?
Penny.
When did you have that dog?
Oh, I don't know, but I remember him. Penny, Penny, Penny.
Look at this.
Eleanor.
That's your mom, right?
Yep.
How about this one?
That's Grandma. Ida.
Do you remember her?
Yeah.
Was she a nice lady?
Yeah.
Did she talk much?
I don't remember her talking.
Was Barney her husband?
Yeah.
Was he a character?
I didn't know him.
You didn't? He was dead already?
I don't know. I don't remember him.
I love this picture.
That's Ben.
Your dad?
My dad.
Looks good in that pic, huh?
Yeah.
You remember him talking much?
Yeah, more or less.
Remember, look at this picture. That was when you were a lifeguard?
Keppel Park, probably.
You're doing pretty good with this quiz of your life. This is a dementia test.
That's the little dog. Little,
Penny?
No, another one. Inky.
Inky?
Crazy. He's got mild dementia, but the love of an animal, transcendent, forever, eternal. So, look, you can listen to that whole thing right now if you're subscribed. If you're not, go to the link in the episode description or click on WTF Plus at WTFpod.com. Okay, tomorrow and Saturday, I will be at Wise Guys in Las Vegas. That's July 15th and 16th. I'm bringing Esther Pavitsky with me. We're going to have fun. My dad's actually driving out from New Mexico with his wife to see some of those. Then I'm back at Dynasty Typewriter in LA for two shows, July 23rd and 24th. Saturday is sold out, but there are still some tickets for Sunday. I'll be at Just for Laughs in Montreal for my gala on Saturday, July 30th, or my gala. I'll also be doing solo shows up there on July 28th and 29th. Then in August, folks, August and September, I'll be in Columbus, Ohio, Indianapolis, Indiana, Louisville, Kentucky, Lincoln, Nebraska, Des Moines, Iowa, Iowa City, Iowa, Tucson, Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona, Boulder, Colorado, and Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Then in October, I'm in London, England, and Dublin, Ireland. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for all dates and ticket info. Okay? Okay. All right, look, I got to go take some vitamins, and I'm having an okay day. And I just got to say, if you can get an okay day in, if your balance between the micro and the macro is tolerable, and one isn't fueling denial, and the other one isn't fueling sort of self-annihilating depression, if you can just ride that line, you're doing all right. Okay? You're doing all right. I don't know what to do, but I know that. You're doing all right. I'm going to play some guitar. Monkey, LaFonda, Cat Angels everywhere.